Indeed. Amen. And thank you. So this sermon, I want to admit to you, feels a little odd to me. I got up this morning early to rewrite it. I had some misgivings. I recognized a little too late the content might be misconstrued. So it might not be well oiled this morning. Neither am I. While the role of the minister is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, I am not here to trigger, but to invite loving dialogue. And like all of us who care and have been paying attention, I've been so concerned about the divisions we face in this country stemming from the current war in Israel and Gaza. It is so hard anymore to find common ground on which to fellowship with people. And I wanted to talk about the work of Loretta Ross, who teaches a model that stands against the harmful practice of calling out that shames people that we don't agree with. And calling out obviously is not specific to any particular situation or group. It's a tactic that has been used by good people to take down bad people. There's a tactic that has been used by bad people to take down good people. From the Salem witch trials to the McCarthy hearings to the Me Too movement, we understand the power of public shaming that is the call-out culture. And we understand the danger to the public when the power to call someone out due to our own fears in an effort to assuage our anger is abused. But when I read the sermon, I realized that it was less about combating call-out culture and more about creating safe spaces, because maybe that's what I want to do. We're also afraid to talk to each other anymore. It becomes difficult to have a conversation for fear of offending somebody or finding out that we disagree on some critical element. And lately, for me and for many folks I've talked to, that element is the war in Gaza, which I sometimes find myself hoping doesn't come up in conversation, when it is the elephant in the room that we perhaps need to talk about. I say all this to say that the stories I'll share today are somewhat about anti-Semitism and the reaction to anti-Semitism that have touched me recently. It isn't particularly a deep conversation, but I think we should have one. The stories I share this morning are only to invite us to consider having conversations that bring us together at this critical time in our history rather than pushing each other away, hoping that the things we don't want to talk about don't come up. A few days ago, I received an email from a Jewish colleague who I had not seen for over a year. The subject line of the email read, "Reaching out." For confidentiality reasons, I've changed any identifying details. It reads, "Lane. I've had a version of this email sitting in my draft for a long time. It's felt weird to send, which is why it's been sitting in my drafts for so long. Because I want to continue to be in relationship with you, both personally and on behalf of the synagogue, I'm reaching out. With all that is going on in the world, and particularly in Gaza, Israel, and here in the US, with the continued use of anti-Semitism to divide communities and stoke fear, I'm reaching out. I was saddened to have not heard from you, but I will not let my disappointment prevent me from continuing to reach out and find the opportunities to work together. I look forward to the opportunity to connect and hear what you're working on in these painful times with hope. Alice," not her name. So my first instinct was to write back immediately. I didn't want her to think ill of me, or that I didn't care about her, or worse, that I was being purposefully vindictive in some kind of way. I'm aware that many folks who consider themselves to be allies in the fight for race equity and social justice have found themselves at odds with each other in the wake of the Gaza attacks and the subsequent actions of Israel, the Israeli government. And I wondered what other interactions that she had experienced in recent months. Even in spaces previously considered safe and inclusive, in this time of rising anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, and also continued anti-Black sentiment, one cannot be sure who one is talking to. Even in politically and socially progressive circles, personal identities run with the level of the soul. Ancestral lines are sacred to us, and we must make space for all of us at the table. I decided to sleep on it. In the morning, I wrote a draft, and I erased it, and I wrote another draft, and I erased that one. When I finally hit send, my response felt lacking. But it read as follows. Alice, thank you for this note. I apologize that I have been a source of disappointment for you, and I'm grateful for your grace. My absence was in no way intentional. I've learned that I am not the best at relationships. This is not an excuse. Please know that I grieve with you this war and the tragic loss of so many lives. I condemn Hamas and terrorism. I am sorry that it is so difficult for all of us to find common ground on which to discuss these extremely painful issues. Your synagogue has been a bright light in the movement to stand against racial oppression, and I have been privileged to support those efforts. I regret that I have been shocked and overwhelmed by the degree of vitriol and hatred expressed in our communities stemming from this war, and have been dealing quite a bit with my own feelings of fragility. I pray that you and your loved ones are finding a path that is healing and confirming for you, and I deeply appreciate your commitment to keeping our relationship whole. Should you be interested in talking either by phone or in person, please let me know. With love and gratitude, Lane. There, it was done. I recognized that I had said too much. I had said too little. Maybe "I'm sorry" would have been enough to say. But I let my fear or my concern run away with me. I wondered if what I had written in response to her email was the response she was looking for. I wondered if she wanted me to reiterate the words that are displayed outside many houses of worship right now, including hers, "We stand with Israel." That is not something that I have been able to say. And I'm embarrassed to say that it had not occurred to me at the outset that my Jewish peers might need to hear from me. After all, I was an activist and a person of color with very definite ideas about the ongoing human rights issues in the Middle East. But it did not take me long after this war began to realize that if I was going to be of service in this moment in our history, my activist hat needed to make way for a minister's collar. Clearly, this was a calling in moment for both me and for Alice. She could have broadcast her disappointment in me onto social media platforms and into activist circles that we share. In times of fear and crisis, we find ourselves looking for safety wherever we can find it. We find ourselves wanting to rid ourselves and our loved ones of whatever we deem to be the source of the affliction. We call people to account for their hurtful behaviors, and that is right to do. In times of crisis, we want to know who our friends are. I get it. I witnessed this yesterday when two ministerial colleagues shared words that resulted in one of them leaving the table. When I asked, how do we keep people at the table for these conversations? The answer was an honest, I don't know. Even those of us who know better and want to do better find it difficult to take care of each other when our identities are threatened, when our people are threatened. A few weeks ago, a black man was dismissed from his job as basketball coach for the Roosevelt School, a public school in Yonkers that has a student body that is largely black and Latinx. You will have heard about this, so I don't feel the need to change the title or anybody's name. Days earlier, they had faced off against a team from Leffel School, a Jewish parochial school in Hartsdale. So you know the game was stopped because some Leffel students reported that the Roosevelt students were taunting them with anti-Semitic comments. I apologize for showing some emotion this morning. This makes me very, very, very sad. The next day, the local papers printed the story, but that was not certainly the end of the story, which soon went national. Politicians jumped into the fray, some calling for investigations, some calling for added security in neighboring schools, some making grandiose statements about what they would and would not tolerate, taking a stand against hate. Others calling on the governor to make a statement, which she did. A Roosevelt player was dismissed, and the coach lost his reputation and his livelihood because someone had to pay. The truth is that kids have been calling each other names and doing mean things to each other since forever. And often, if not always, the harm that kids do to each other mirrors the harm they see and experience in the world. Global events are certainly a key factor in the rise in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in this country, and certainly they are a key source of division in our communities at this time. Having said that, systems of oppression run deep. They're entrenched in our social and political structures. No one feels safe right now. Politicians, rather than adding to an already divisive and fearful environment with incendiary rhetoric, could have taken a beat before reacting. Rather than rushing to condemn the coach, school officials could perhaps have used his relationship with the students and the community to leverage an opportunity for education and healing. And while I would never minimize the gravity of anti-Semitism, it is grave indeed. Blaming individual people or even groups of people for the ills of entire society does nothing to repair the harm they may have caused. We are an easily wounded species, and we wear those wounds on our sleeves. We want to be able to blame someone for the bad that happens to us and the bad that happens in the world. Whatever we cannot be with, whatever makes us uncomfortable, it must be someone else's fault. And those people must be expelled for the good of ourselves and for the good of those we care about. Those people and their ideas must be canceled. It is true that sometimes public shaming is the only way to get people in power to stop creating harm. But the way that it is being used to exile people is costing us. Call-out culture has taken over our social and political platforms at great expense to our society. Social condemnation denies people an opportunity to explore the harm that they may have caused and the ways that they can make restitution appropriately. This just further divides an already divided society that finds it difficult to think, speak, or listen beyond their own opinion or understanding. This is not good. It is also not new. How do we get people to stay at the table? Professor Loretta Ross is challenging call-out culture. radical black feminist in her 70s, Professor Ross has been doing human rights work for four decades. Recognized as one of the founders of the reproductive justice movement, she has been honored for her work as an activist, and her 2020 and 2021 TED Talk videos have been viewed by millions. In a 2020 New York Times article, Ross says she thinks call-out culture has taken conversations that could have once been learning opportunities and turned them into mud wrestling on social media platforms and college campuses. Ross says, I think you can understand how calling out is toxic. It really does alienate people and makes them fearful of speaking up. In contrast, she says, calling in is just simply calling out with love. And of course, there isn't anything really, well, let me say this. It might be simple, but it ain't easy. Ross credits her mentor, civil rights icon, Reverend Dr. C.T. Vivian, with the phrase she uses to ground herself in her work. Quote, she quotes him as saying, if we are going to ask people to give up hate, we need to be there for them when they do. Hatred is a way of life. It is the armor of a wounded spirit. We need to be courageous enough to model an alternative. This is hard and necessary work. Calling in and calling out have the same goal, to hold people accountable. The difference is that calling in eschews the use of public shaming or vilification in favor of an approach that is conversational and inclusive. The first step of calling someone in is to have their best interest at heart, while asking them to account. Calling in conversations are approached with respect and kindness, but remain firm in communicating the impact of people's actions. While calling out assumes the worst about people's motivations, calling in gives people an opportunity to show up as their best selves with all their baggage, inviting civil, compassionate, contextual conversations between parties who disagree, and giving space for pain, anger, frustration, and fear to be expressed responsibly. When someone says they hurt, it is not appropriate for us to necessarily say, in that moment, yeah, me too. Sometimes the answer is, tell me more. This is not to say that we should allow ourselves to be mistreated. Some activist groups have warned that the calling in movement is a distraction that takes the focus off the goal of impacting systemic racism and oppression. This is a valid concern. We must not stop speaking truth to power. But we also must find a way to relate with each other in a way that restores us to community with each other rather than repels us away from community. We have to avoid the us versus them mentality. We have to give people the benefit of the doubt. We need to acknowledge that diverse people with diverse ideas can work together. Just because we're working on the same project does not mean we feel the same way about all of the issues in our lives. We do not need to agree on everything to be in community. We need to use active listening techniques to make people feel heard and acknowledged, because then they can put down the sword. They can take off the armor. In an article published in Learning for Justice magazine titled Speaking Up Without Tearing Down, Professor Ross says that call-ins are agreements between people who work together to consciously help each other expand their perspectives. They encourage us to recognize our requirements for growth and to admit our mistakes and commit to doing better. We have all made mistakes. Calling in relationships that are without We are not guaranteed relationships that are without conflict. Those relationships are not authentic. We can expect wounding to occur, but when it does, we must hold the door open to repair what has been broken. It is true that I am not that great at relationships. I don't often wade into where I have not been invited, and I don't always feel welcome even when the invitation has been extended. I'm socially awkward and more than a little high maintenance, which is more common than you might think among ministers. The good thing about calling in culture is that leadership is collaborative. Working with and across racial and cultural differences to garner a common understanding for peaceful resolution is the way things are done. I am grateful to my colleagues and my journey mates who continue to extend the hand of partnership even when I miss the cue. I close this morning with the words of Professor Ross, who says, "It is my privilege to figure out a strategy for working with everybody who means well." May it be so for all of us. We have reached the time for congregational sharing. I invite feedback, suggestions, ruminations of the soul. Thank you, Bob, for being my microphone passer.
Thank you, Reverend Lane. There was so much in there to chew on and so much that resonates. I would love to start brainstorming next steps where some of this can actually happen for me personally. And it's such important practice, listening and allowing a way for people back in to feel that they are worthy, because the words we send out, people can take in as their identity. And if you put out negative, rather than making that person change, it often makes that person feel that and become that. So I'm very grateful for your thoughts.
Hi, Ralph. Yeah, I thought that was a wonderful and very timely discussion, and appreciate the way you did it so personally and candidly. I think from my own standpoint, I try to remember to be humble and to listen, to not assume that I always know the only right way to do things, that I'm not a perfect person, and I can't expect other people to be perfect either. But the other thing that's aggravating our current situation is social media, and especially the fact that people oftentimes are expressing their opinions anonymously, which allows them to try to take people down as a way of enhancing their own opinion of themselves, which has become a very vicious part of cancel culture.
I just wanted to say I think you're too hard on yourself, and I think it was a very well-oiled and inspirational talk, so thank you.
I agree with Jim. I thank you for the sermon, and I thank you for your openness about yourself and your honesty. I really appreciate that. And I also want to say I am Jewish, and I have family in Israel, and it's a very hard time. I hate Netanyahu, as most Israelis do, and I think I don't like what he's doing. And I am very mixed about what's happening in Israel. So I just want to share that with you.
I have an example to share. My partner and I were at a family gathering, and the subject of Israel and Gaza came up, and a young grandson really trashed my wife's opinions, who is Jewish, but not pro-Israel at this particular moment. And she came home to me and she said, boy, he ripped me apart. And I said, this is like Thanksgiving during World War. And you can't talk to your own family. One thing that I have found helpful is reading something that is more than a headline and is written by someone who knows the story and tries as hard as possible to be balanced in his estimate. And right now, I find that person to be David Remnick, who is the editor of the New Yorker. And he is Israeli by birth and comes across with, I sort of don't like either one of these, but tries to dissect Netanyahu's lineage and his political aspirations, and at the same time look at the October 7th attack with clear eyes and fairness. So.
Thank you, Lane. I think I asked you to challenge us this morning, and you certainly did. We all talk about, in my work and in other organizations, we always have like a diversity moment. And we talk about diversity of ethnicity, diversity of gender. I think we need to celebrate diversity of thought and opinion and acknowledge that too. We tend to think that there's black and white, right and wrong. And it's not, it's a spectrum, and we need to consider that. We also talk to people about how you communicate to somebody who may have lost a loved one, you know, and not try to use I words and, you know, try to be empathetic and think about where they're coming from. And I think we have to, the same thing about concern for the world. We need to understand. And our first question should not be how we feel. It's, you know, try to understand where they're coming from. We need to learn that. It's a skill we have to develop.
My world, Bob, is microcosm. And it's funny. Like, there's a social work group about anti-Semitism in social work, and trying to keep my ship on an even keel. And I get a knot in my stomach with the prospect of going to the meeting. I don't go.
Yeah, I'd like to say I loved your talk. And, you know, I got a letter from President Biden because he wanted money. And he they asked me all the things that I wanted. And I said to be pro-Israel and pro-Palestine. That was my first choice. And I just want to express something about communication and love. because I need that when I went for my heart operation and other things, and I'm 80 now, you know about me. Okay, Tracy Brenneman, who fell down the stairs about 8 years ago, gave me and Gretchen a big pot. That's right, Gretchen and I. Okay, a violet, a pot of violet, okay? And we've been watering it ever since. And on the pot says love. Now, for all these years, I have been, we watered it, it's blooming wonderfully. And I just want to use that example of Tracy being so kind to me in the Croton Unitarian Church, and her two children coming to my door during Halloween and, you know, asking for candy. I have pictures of Gretchen. Gretchen can add more. Okay, singing songs to me. I'll let her add it. But the point is, she showed me so much love that the violet is still blooming. And since she fell down the stairs, I feel badly, but I wanted to spread the love that she's loved me for so many years, and the kids were so loving. And I just wanted to express that's what I would like to do with the Palestinians and the Israelis. And I say, God help us, we should all try to be like Tracy.
Oh, I love it. Wow. What a wonderful place to end this conversation.